I'm like slightly behind schedule because I struggled to function today.
Well, I'm sure it'll be much better tomorrow when it's 5 degrees hotter.
Did you see everyone talking about that elephant with a grudge on Twitter yesterday?
No, I was working. I feel like it's what was happening?
Relevant.
Tell me about the
apparently, there was an elephant in India that like basically trampled a woman to death and then like went to her funeral and stomped out the pyre and chucked the body off somewhere. And I think like went and trashed her house as well. Like, this elephant had a grudge.
Was that definitely an elephant, or was it like three human enemies in a trench coat?
No, well, everyone was sort of tweeting about it, like, yeah, no, elephants do have really good memories and they will fucking hold grudges and shit. And everyone's like, I'm sure it is justified, but we all want to know what the woman did to the elephant.
Yeah. Well, no, I know that elephants hold grudges and have long memories, and like, there have been a lot of recorded instances of this, but I don't know how well they can read like funeral invitations and addresses.
Well, I'm guessing it all happened in like quite a small area.
All right, yeah.
I didn't like deep dive into the facts. I just thought it would be fun to talk about an elephant with a grudge.
Agreed.
But like, what do you do to piss an elephant off that badly?
I mean, use it for work, probably.
Oh yeah, good point.
Yeah. Almost anything that people do to elephants is bad, so.
I was trying to think of like entertaining answers, like.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah, no.
like a social snub, didn't invite him to tea, that kind of thing.
So yeah, we are following our long-held tradition of talking about the weather, because that is our culture. It is hotter than it has been today. Today it is hot. Tomorrow it will be hotter still. We're both wearing dresses.
We are.
It's not unusual for Joanna, but for me it is.
It's too warm.
Joanna's wearing a crown, which is normal summer wear.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you not have a summer crown?
Yes, but mine is far too florid and huge to fit under my headphones. So.
Oh, okay, that's fair enough. I'll allow that. You gave me this crown.
I know.
It seems the appropriate hat for this month.
Good-natured hat mocking.
But yes, no, it's very, very warm. And I've discovered that this is, in fact, the warmest room in my flat for most of the day. So now I'm just sweating like a little pig.
Have you tried putting the fan in there? I mean, not while recording, but...
You've seen this room. Where the fuck would I put a fan? There's no
hang it from the ceiling. Well, do you remember at the Nutshell they did that?
Oh yeah, it was like duct tape to the wall, duct tape to the ceiling.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah,
oh, I'm not going to spend on my electricity just to duct tape a fan to the ceiling.
All right, I disagree with that conclusion, but I understand it.
Especially as I couldn't have it on while we're recording.
Well, yeah, is that not your sewing room though?
Yeah, but I literally come and do the sewing in here, like all the cutting and marking and everything. Okay. I go and do on my bigger table.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's mostly fair. I didn't really think about the logistics of having that nice cross breeze when trying to work with pattern tissue paper and silk.
Sounds horrible. All your hobbies sound so difficult.
Everything is very stressful.
I play with colours. It's much more peaceful.
After this, I'm going to have a little break from sewing. I don't need anything else. Until I have a huge clear out, I don't need anything else.
Joanna is sewing a friend's prom dress, by the way, listeners.
Yes. So
I'll probably skip that whole bit where we...
Which is irritating.
Played with our microphones, half talked about that.
I'm making a lovely ball gown and it's not for me. That's very upset. This is why I don't sew for other people. Because mm-hmm. after
for
all
me?
Of this...
You made me a nice dress.
Well, yeah, that's fine. Those were nice for you, but they weren't ball gowns. This is very upsetting to put this much work into a ball gown that I won't wear.
Mm. Yeah, understandable.
And I'm not going to make myself a ball gown because...
There's only so many balls.
I don't go to a lot of balls.
Weirdly enough, in our status of not even a little bit aristocratic, nor just talking to anybody in that circle, we don't get invited to any diplomatic balls. There's probably better. I mean, I'm not that fond of Ferrero Rocher, and a lot of them do get shot up from what I remember from popular culture. So,
I would like to go to like an old school, you know, fantasy masquerade ball.
A la Witches Abroad.
Yes, but with less of the frog guy thing.
I think it would be worth putting up with the frog guy for human Grebo.
Yeah, good point. / Cassananda.
You have to kiss 100 frog guys to find your
humanoid
sexy cat guy. Oh no. No, cat boys. Oh, Tumblr ruined everything.
Grebo is a cat boy.
Oh. Well, no, I've upset myself.
Did you remember when I went through that very brief phase of wearing like all black with those really cute little gold cat ears? And whenever
genuinely
anyone
else... no,
It was
Yes, I've got a picture of you. Yes.
Yeah, I was Goth Kitty.
Yeah, they were a thing for a while, actually, weren't they? Rose gold.
Yep.
Ears. I quite like rose gold, but it has made it really difficult to find anything in copper, which is a colour I like more. Because now everything is in gold, silver, or rose gold. And I like copper and bronze as a...
Fair. I like bronze. I do like bronze. I've got a very nice chunky copper bangle that's gone down the back of some shelves and I need to dig out.
I have a litter picker, which I did buy to pick litter, but I'm going to be honest, is mainly used to get things from behind things in my house. In my defense, I got it to clear out some of the river behind my house, and I didn't realize when I got it that that river becomes 90% nettles for most of the summer and 90% flood for most of the rest of the year. So there's about 2 weeks where you can realistically do something about that. Yeah. I've got limited commitment to that, so being wet or nettled is not really on the cards for me.
Wet or nettled, title of your sex tape.
I've been rewatching early Brooklyn Nine-Nine, so I should have been primed for that. I was really cute. I'd forgotten how much I liked the first season.
Yeah, it's quite sweet in the early episodes. I haven't seen like the latest seasons, or I think like the final seasons coming out.
I've watched the final season now, yeah. Most of it's on... Yeah, pretty good, yeah. I mean, it's not... I don't like it as much as I liked the early season. I didn't like the last three seasons as much as I liked the first three seasons, put it that way. Yeah. But that's not because of any like plot differences or anything like that. It's mainly because they did that thing where they take the part of a character that's funny because it's rare and keep doing it over and over again. Like Captain Holt breaking the statue look.
Yeah.
It's like he was constantly doing that from like season, whatever, two seasons ago onwards.
Yeah, it's the, if you let a show run too long, it becomes, every character becomes like just a parody of themselves, and it gets really painful to watch.
Flanderization, I think it's called.
Yes.
Yeah, anyway, Holt got flanderized and that made me sad.
Oh, that's a shame.
Does sound like a cooking technique, doesn't it?
I'm showing my friend Parks and Rec for the first time at the moment, which is mostly a fun game of him going, but that person was in that.
Ah, yes.
It's also that when Megan Mullally playing Tammy comes on for the first time and I get to go into the, oh, but you don't get it. So she's actually married to him in real life. And she was in Will and Grace, and they met on the set of Will and Grace when he was a plumber and she kissed him and it was a thing.
I didn't know that.
Did you? Yeah, they met on the set of Will and Grace. He played a plumber. She kissed him. It was a thing. I don't know what I was clarifying by just repeating.
No, I don't know either, but I really enjoyed it.
It just brings me a lot of joy because they make a really cute couple.
Oh, that's so nice. I really like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia for that reason. Dee and Mac are married in real life.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
Which makes it even funny that they're just horrible to each other all the time. What have you been watching?
What have I been watching? Well, the new series Kenobi is out. I haven't seen the latest episode yet, but I'm enjoying that. Good. Less for being a huge Star Wars nerd and more for older Ewan McGregor with a beard.
There's something called Ms. Marvel that's come out. Is that good?
Yes, I've seen the first episode so far. It's really good. I'm really enjoying it. It's fun. It's like a bit teen girly as far as Marvel shows go.
Is she a teenage girl?
She is a teenage girl, and okay. She is a well-written teenage girl. And good. She is played by a teenage girl.
Well, that's it, because I didn't know. Because the one thing I know about Ms. Marvel and the reason I like it, I'm never going to watch it, but the banner on the PlayStation TV bit is of Ms. Marvel, and it's usually of some grim male-oriented show, so it's just nice to have some colours. I was like, but it's so stylized, I can't tell if that's a teenage girl or a very young-looking woman.
She's a teenage girl, but it's also quite nice because the whole idea of the character is she's a huge obsessed with the Avengers before she realises she's a superhero.
Yeah.
And the actress playing her is like a huge, huge Marvel nerd before she got cast. Oh. There's all these sweet stories about like she was watching WandaVision while they were filming Ms. Marvel.
Oh gosh, that makes me feel sick, but I'm glad for her.
It's just a very sweet fan thing.
The entire Marvel feedback loop makes me, I wouldn't yuck anyone's yums, and I understand why people like it. I just don't, the entire thing gives me the slight ick.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think it's the budgets, it's all of the corporateness about it.
It is insane when you kind of think about it objectively, like the giant money machine that it is, but I like it. I find it entertaining.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure it is. I think it's since it got part of Disney as well. It just
Well, it's the weird, like, homogenization because, like, everything is slowly coming under this one umbrella.
Yeah, and I feel like it's all kind of tramping slightly towards averageness because of that. I think we've talked about that before, whereas the TV shows aren't so much, by like, the movies.
Yeah, it does very much so.
Lowest common denominator, smugness.
Although I will slightly defend the movies because Doctor Strange 2 was Sam Raimi and he lent into his horror roots a lot and it doesn't feel samey.
Cool.
It's, I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't love all the horror stuff because it's not really my thing. I could kind of appreciate that there was a thing being done.
Yeah.
That was enjoyable.
That's cool. I get that. Yeah, I like horror movies for me, same as very spicy food. I just cannot do it. I can't do it, but I can appreciate like the taste, the craftsmanship underneath.
Yes, I'm like, it's just
this
not your cup of tea.
Is physically painful and I cannot continue, but I can recommend this to somebody else. Mm. Now, please allow me to go and have a nightmare. That goes for spicy food or horror movies.
Yeah. Non-MCU, but on Disney Plus thing, the How I Met Your Mother reboot, How I Met Your Father came out.
That's the banner it replaced, actually. It wasn't even a male-oriented one. That made me feel sick. How's that? Have you watched it?
Yeah, I have watched it. It's okay. I have a giant crush on Hilary Duff, so I am not looking at
Hilary
it logically.
Duff in it?
Hilary Duff's the main character.
Oh, well, do you know what? I'd probably watch it for that.
It's, not only is Hilary Duff the main character, but
love Hilary Duff.
The older version who's telling her story is Kim Cattrall.
Oh, that's pretty
cool. Who I also have a giant crush on.
Yeah, so I'm watching it.
Yeah. Anyway, we have talked about nothing relevant to the Discord whatsoever.
That's not true. You brought up an elephant and I steered us immediately away from it.
Yeah, right. Fair point. I've got an important question for you, Francine. Do you want some Pwingies for the room?
Oh, fuck you. Fuck.
I'm sorry.
I should stop letting myself go onto Reddit via Twitter. It's the worst of both worlds. We'll link in the show notes, listeners, but I refuse to talk about it further.
That's fine. Do you want to make a podcast then?
Yes, I would like to make a podcast though.
Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part two of our discussion of the fifth elephant.
The drama is beginning.
The collapsing candelabra. Right, note on spoilers before we crack on. We are a spoiler-light podcast, heavy spoilers for the book The Fifth Elephant.
Including that one we just did.
Including that one about the falling candelabra, but that was this section. But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series.
Any future candelabras.
Including any future candelabras.
Which may or may not fall.
And we are saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Oh, fuck. Oh, it's the first time I've not been able to come up with one on the fly for ages. Come on the journey with us, running with a wolf pack, barely keeping up.
Good effort. There you go.
Running in the flattened snow in the wake of a wolf pack until you fall exhausted onto the ground.
There we go.
There we are.
And then on a sled.
And then on a sled, yes.
I just listened to that. Sorry, this isn't relevant, but I just listened to that You're Wrong About episode about the Dyatlov Pass incident. And it was kind of the intention of the episode, but it did make me really want to like go hiking in snow with a wolf pack.
I'm not sure I'd keep up with a wolf pack.
Well, no, but like sled dogs, maybe. Like, I want to go like sledding in the wilderness, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have we got anything to follow up on other than the Dyatlov Pass incident?
Yeah. I was stuttering over as much as I am now the scone stone. And it is the, in fact, pronounced scun, the place, or scun. I can't do it properly. As a couple of listeners have told me. Thank you, listeners. I very seldom embed corrections in the actual episode, but I'm really annoyed with myself here. It's pronounced scoon, not scun. I don't know how I wrote that down and misremembered it so poorly. Two listeners told me very clearly how it's pronounced. I do apologise. And so when we talk here about the
scone of stone.
Right.
Speaking of the scone of stone. Would you like to tell us what happened previously on Fifth Elephant? Yeah.
Something's afoot in Uberwald, and it's spilling into Ankh-Morpork. The Low King's coronation demands high society guests, and Vetinari has Vimes in mind as an ambassador. And no, he doesn't have a choice. So the desultory duke, his well-bred wife, assorted attachés, and a peculiar pen pusher pile into a couple of coaches for the long journey to the old country, while back home, a much depleted watch tries to solve the riddle of what happened to the scun of stun replica. I've made it worse. Good. Meanwhile, news from home has Angua heading to Oberwald on a different path, followed by kind of Captain Carrot and his brave little dog. Carrot is driven by love, but not, unfortunately, by anything more substantial, and is woefully unequipped for cross-country pursuit in the snow. But just as his considerable energy drains, Angua turns back. Surely he couldn't have known that that would happen.
Surely. Shall I tell us what happened this time?
Yeah, all right.
Then we'll dive in. So, on this section of The Fifth Elephant, Vimes and his ragtag retinue find themselves rudely interrupted by bandits at the Wilderness Pass. I don't want to let pass the joke that I just wrote for myself and my little son, Marie, so I put an exclamation point after bandits, so it's like Panic at the Disco, but it's bandits at the Wilderness Pass.
Cute.
I just need you all to know that.
Oh, that's nice. I like that.
Sybil's briefly a hostage as Inigo gets nasty and fills Vimes in on his assassin scholarship as they travel on to the inn. Meanwhile, Carrot wakes under a pile of wolves. Angua's been having family trouble and Carrot's determined to join the journey to Uberwald and help out. Vimes attracts rumours as bandit bodies are found and isn't daunted by dwarven document checks as they make their way to Bonk. Meanwhile, back in the city, Colan faces controversy as the newly formed Guild of Watchmen goes on strike. In Bonk, Vimes learns that the genuine Scun of Stun is missing, as is Wando Sleeps, the acting consul. As Sybil starts preparing carpets in the consulate, Vimes heads out to present his credentials, starting with the new low king. There's tension in the mines, and Vimes gets a midnight request from Dee, the king's ideas taster. To the Lady Margalotta next, who gets subtle about politics and drinks, as dwarves face the threat of no longer being dwarves. Then to the werewolves, who can't quite manage subtlety, but get the pointy teeth across. On return to the embassy, Igor has been injured in not an accident, and Vimes and Sybil ride out to the clacks to find them abandoned, with controls smashed. Inigo stays to wait till dark and send off a flare, while Sybil shows Sam a newly discovered spy room at the embassy. Inigo is attacked, but Vimes is none the wiser as he prepares for a reception in the dwarves' candlelit caverns. As Iron Axe and Bloodhammer plays out, Vimes visits where the scone isn't and starts looking for the crime amongst white sand and a ransom note from Aggie Hammerthief. As mineshaft meetings mingle and Vimes meets Wolfgang von Uberwald, Angua's less sane brother, they await a formal presentation to the new low king. But disaster strikes as Vimes leaps to rescue Rhys from a falling cavalcade of candle wax as a chandelier descends.
Super.
Helicopter and loincloths.
Oh, yeah. Go on.
Well, someone's flying about. Someone's a helicopter. Don't know who. Someone.
Okay.
It's implied. Someone's flying about a bit.
Sure. And what about the boat being lifted in the...
Yeah, sure. I'll do.
Don't be like offhand with me as though I'm the one whose fault this is.
But it annoys you so much more than I when I do. And I feel like that's like become a key part of the bit.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, agreed. It does annoy me more. All right, continue.
Kind of lacking in loincloths, but Detritus has got a lovely new suit and I'm very happy for him. So I'm going to take this loincloth watch to celebrate his cultural attaché look.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And as cultural attaché, he does, of course, celebrate loincloths himself, I'm sure. Right, quotes.
Something bad was going on. He could smell the tension, the sense of quiet panic. The air was thick with it. Occasionally other dwarfs scuttled past, distracted on some mission. Something was very bad. People didn't know what to do next, so they were trying to do everything. And in the middle of this, important officers had to stop what they were doing because some idiot from some distant city had to hand over a piece of paper.
That's good.
I particularly enjoy that kind of mental image of just sheer panic in the mines.
Panic in the mines.
Panic at the mines. What was your quote, Francine?
The door slid back. Vimes looked out onto the night sky underground. The stars were all around him. Below him. I think we went down too far, he said. I like that because he thought they'd gone all the way through Greater Tuin, I guess.
Did we go through a turtle?
I don't know. I read that a couple of times. Like, huh, that's very sweet and disorienting.
That weird feeling of having gone so far you can't work out where you are, like you lose all sense of space.
Yeah. Also happens if you just wake up in a different bed than usual.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember once waking up on a sofa and not realizing straight away, I'm sort of doing the, hang on, I don't have Risk.
Yeah.
My TV doesn't go there. There's a guy in a spider costume. No, I'm in a spider costume.
No, I remember that night.
That was a weird Christmas.
Yeah.
Anyway, characters. Let's talk about characters. Let me start with Inigo, because this section really starts with him coming out swinging.
Yeah, and ends with him going out swinging.
Yes, R.I.P. He did his best.
He did a good job.
He did a very good job.
I think this is a good place in the book to take out the overpowered character, though, you know?
Yes.
Because until now, they've had the, it's like getting rid of Gandalf, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Except I don't think he comes back at the end.
Inigo the White.
Yeah.
Also, I can't imagine Gandalf like slamming a hand into someone's neck and their head coming off.
Well, you and I have very different headcanons.
Now in my AU,
Gandalf has ninja stars.
But so something interesting that occurred to me when I was doing the notes for this, because that's why I have sort of Vimes next, is how do you think it feels for Vimes to have someone like Inigo sent along with him, especially by Vettinari?
I think logically he gets it.
Yeah.
He knows that he's not as powerful, as competent as usual. He's a city boy. He's gone over this a lot of times, but I think in everything but logically, it must hurt like a bitch.
Well, especially because Inigo's actions and techniques are the sort of things that Vimes just would never approve of. Not him as a cultural expert on where they're going, but the violent side of Inigo with the weapons.
Yeah.
And I do think Vimes like has a grudging respect for him by the time he leaves him in the Clax Tower.
Yeah, I mean, they're two working class boys done good, aren't they?
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, they do call each other like the fellow bastards kind of thing.
There's quite a sweet camaraderie there. But yeah, I can imagine Vimes being like quite upset that he's sort of got this to supervise.
Yeah. I found it interesting that Pratchett used the same kind of wording for Inigo with like the calling him a butcher that he doesn't mind killing as he does with his villains usually. I think this is the only time I can recall so far where someone who's not coded as an antagonist has that kind of aptitude for killing.
Yeah.
Apart from Cohen the Barbarian,
obviously. Yeah.
That doesn't count. That's a comedy. Comedy murders.
Well, it kind of, spoilers for later in the podcast, but when I start looking at this, part of the thing is Inigo is not a bad guy in that he's trying to do what's best for Ankh Morpork first. And the book really makes you question a bit, is what's best for Ankh Morpork what's best?
Yeah. Yeah, he's being good at his job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's very competent. And as you said, he's not an antagonist.
I do always appreciate someone dying mid-catchphrase. I just think that's funny.
Mm-mm. Yep.
Oh, we haven't really tried out his laugh yet, have we? I think it's a... as somebody with a constant nervous laugh, I get it.
I imagine it as a bit kind of Muttley from Wacky Races, to be honest.
Oh, no. It's more...
Well, like posh Muttley.
Okay. Talking about his, like, his fighting techniques and how Vimes feels about them, I thought Vimes with the gun.
Yeah.
Was a really interesting contrast from back in Feet of Clay, actually, because in Feet of Clay, there was this huge, long scene about Vimes struggling with the idea of using it and eventually allowing Carrot to take it from him.
Men-at-Arms.
Men-at-Arms, sorry.
But it's not quite a gun here. It's like a very powerful single-shot crossbow.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
That's the idea for the purpose of this comparison. It is, you know, a single-shot weapon he would hate to use. And I mean, I know later he kind of excuses it by saying he was going for the shoulder, whatever, but I don't know. I suppose the difference is largely that he's protecting Sybil.
Yeah, I think that makes a huge difference to what he's willing to do. Yeah.
He's not bringing a murderer to justice. He's not.
Yeah, he's not doing his job. He's doing his person.
Yeah, person job.
Person job.
I didn't make it better, but I added another word, and isn't that what matters? Wow, ooh, that's the least editor thing I've ever said.
Like, going on to Vimes, his reaction to Inigo's weapons, he's got this... explains this difference between, you know, you have them so you don't have to kill people, they're for having, for warning.
Open carry.
This is for hiding until you bring it out and kill someone in the dark. Mm-hmm. And he's clear on that distinction because he has to be.
Yeah. Again, I think he might be giving himself the benefit of a doubt a lot of the time because he's a bar fighter. He's a brawler. He's not like a, he's not Queensbury rules. He's not Carrot.
No.
And I get he doesn't like sneakiness about it, but I feel like that's just because his job doesn't call for it more than he's above it. But I get why he would be seeing himself in this way, especially when he's on this weird trip.
I think he wants to put himself above the assassins.
Yeah, for sure.
He doesn't want to think of them as on the same footing.
And I get that, because it must be infuriating talking to people who literally try and kill him for a living and then being like, oh, we didn't play the game properly. He's like, fuck you. No, stop shooting at me.
Yeah. The explanation of what he's done with some of the assassins that come after him makes me laugh, though. He sends one on a ship bound for Gat via Cape Terror. Mm-hmm. And not to take the chains off before the bingo. I really should have got the map out for this one, just to try and track that journey.
Ah, we forgot the fucking map.
Next week.
Sure, yeah.
I think our listeners just had exactly the same reaction.
If it makes you feel any better, listeners, I'm just as disappointed in me as you are. In fact, far more so. I've had 30 years of this.
It's just constant. It never goes away. And yes, one of the others was found tied to a fountain, painted pig and pink and with a flag somewhere, which is that's an effort.
Mate, it sends a message. It is a deterrent. I'm not sure where to shoehorn this, but I really enjoyed dwarf brackets indicating miscreant.
I didn't know where to shoehorn that either, so I'm glad you've just pulled that up there.
Is it one of your favourites as well, Joanna? Brackets indicating miscreant.
I like the gentle sort of admonishment from Inigo of maybe not the time for your street dwarfish.
Yeah. But I like that it wasn't just Vines being shit at dwarfish. It is like, it's just the way you talk to each other. That's quite a nice
implication. It's the sort of colloquial dwarfish he's picked up on the streets of Ankh-Morpork is not the diplomatic dwarfish you use in Uberwald.
It's the equivalent of me going, you're right, dickhead.
Which there's a time and a place for, and it's not when you're having your papers checked.
No. I very rarely insult people looking at my ambassadorial?
Yeah, ambassadorial credentials.
Credentials. Credentials, there we go. We got there. Too many syllables altogether in that off-the-cuff remark.
Far too many.
I liked Margalotta's appraisal of Vimes as just a very angry man. You can see it piling up behind his patience. I wonder how far he can be pushed. Brackets, I wonder how far I can push him.
Yes.
Vimes is not hiding it. Well, I think we can get. Yeah.
It's very clear that Vimes has a breaking point. And he's a quite a rather large collection of titles now.
Oh, yes. Have you got them?
So he is His Grace, His Excellency, the Duke of Ankh, Commander Sir Samuel Vimes. And His Grace does not cancel out Sir.
Right.
Because he's going with the full set of titles, and he's got Blackboard Monitor as a tiebreaker.
Yes.
Which I like very... Obviously, it feels like a throwaway joke, and then like less than 20 pages later... kind of gets held up as a very important title for him.
Yes.
Because he doesn't think about the kind of cultural relevance of it to the dwarfs.
No. And neither does Inigo, actually, does he? Which is interesting. Doesn't.
I think it's kind of a, no matter how much you learn about a group of people to be for the sake of diplomacy, you'll never know the ins and outs in the same way, such as
Blackboard Monitor. When does that ever come up? Yeah.
No. And then after Vimes, you've got Sybil.
Yay. She's doing well.
Some good moments.
Oh, yeah. That's a real Sybil character in this.
Vimes doesn't realise that she's upset was really upsetting. Where the sort of innkeeper's wife is the one who picks up on it, and he suddenly turns around and is like, oh, fuck, she's shaking and crying.
Yeah. Well, because she's doing so well.
And he's really proud of her for, you know, coping perfectly well with being taken hostage.
Yes, and you know what, she may well have been, she may not have felt an ounce of fear in the moment, but it's once the adrenaline wears off, isn't it?
Yeah,
suddenly you are shaking and crying. Yeah.
Breakdown-y moment.
Yeah, I say that like somebody's really experienced in being held hostage at Crossway Point, but no.
I've never been held hostage
in general,
at Crossway Point.
Once you're out of a risky situation, that's when it hits. I've had
trauma. Yes. I also very much enjoy, she's trying to explain this whole thing about measuring for carpets and finding this room. And Sam immediately goes into the not really listening thing. And she goes, think like a policeman. I am telling you about this for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And he's immediately, oh, fuck, wait, yeah, no, sorry, what?
And the two of them actually working together on the kind of no, we're not going to throw our cohorts under the bus because of your bigotry, actually.
Yeah.
Vimes and Sybil very much on the same page here.
It's Vimes her
and Sybil,
immediate...
Sam and Sybil, both Vimeses.
The Vimeses. Her immediate, and there's a reason I sort of wanted to follow Sybil up with Cheery, because her immediate exception of Cheery for everything she is, and taking her on as a lady's maid, I think, is particularly sweet.
Yes. I did also actually like Vimes's appraisal of her. Well, thought Vimes, she comes from a family where people go off in strange clothes to face explosions far away from the sun. Very nice, he said. To the sequin dress.
Yes. Oh, the sequin dress bit, actually, I love for many reasons. And like I said, I'm saving my big, oh, yay, gender for next week.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you put it in this week or not. There are more things to be said, so.
Yeah, I'm going to save it and do it all in one hit. One big gender.
That sounds terrible. The gender reveal party of the podcast.
Fuck off.
It's gender brackets opinion reveal.
Cheery gets to show off her lovely new ball gown, and there's sort of this explanation of they've decided in their bones if they were going to overturn thousands of years of subterranean tradition, they weren't going to go through all that for no damn twin satin pearls. Mm-hmm. Which A, is that kind of thing when you start really experiencing gender euphoria for the first time, you almost want to go like all the way in the other direction. Mm-hmm. But also I quite like it as a comparison to Lady Margolotta, whose whole aesthetic is not looking like a traditional vampire and very much embracing the twin set and pearls.
Yeah, yeah.
With bats. With bats. It's a nice comparison to draw.
I'm not getting rid of my identity. I'm simply tailoring it.
And adding sequins.
Of course.
But Albrecht's reaction to her and Vimes' immediate kind of jumping to a defence, and it's almost a bit like he's gone, hang on, I miss Sybil getting upset, and maybe I need to make sure I jump to the defence of the women in my life a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the ones getting a bit of shit here.
And I mean, Detritus does the same, doesn't he? And neither of them are having slurs thrown at Cherie.
Detritus, when it comes to Cherie, Detritus is always very sweet, but especially when it comes to Cherie.
I know, there's probably a little bit of, like, regretsies. I shouldn't say regretsies when I'm talking about the death of a colleague, but that's for when I go out without an umbrella, not for Cuddy? No.
Cuddy.
Yeah.
It was Cuddy. Acting Constable Cuddy. We heartily knew
F5.
You.
F5. Leaning into that.
But there's just a very good moment where Vimes is very quietly supportive when they've come out of the mine, and he sort of notices Cheery was... Vine saw that Cheery was shaking, and he kind of gives her the out of cold air really hits you after the warmth underground, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And lets her just have that gently instead of deeply going into, hey, so how was that traumatizing for you?
Mm. Absolutely. Now, I enjoy doing the opposite to you when you're crying because the wind is in your eyes. And I say, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize this coffee shop upset you so.
That's the kind of friendship we have.
But I would do it the proper way around for you, should the need arise. I just enjoy deliberately misinterpreting things.
Yeah, no, that's fair. But yeah, I feel a bit for Cheery and for Detritus, especially in this section, because they've kind of been... Vimes has trotted them out to use them as like these kind of political game pieces of being extra rank more Porkian, and not really thought about what it must feel like for them to go into this situation.
Yes. I think he was pretty inquisitive before they left, though. It's like, are you sure you're okay with this kind of stuff?
Yeah, he does kind of check it out with them.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, he doesn't realise the gravity of it until that moment where they're approaching the king.
And he's like, shit, I brought
a fucking
troll.
What have I done? It's, you get it, though, don't you? It's like, in the moment of, you know, righteous anger or just righteousness generally, you take an action, and then as its consequence approaches, you're like, oh no, consequences.
Yes.
Oh no. Oh, who and could have foreseen this? Shut up, everybody who told me. Who could have foreseen this?
What is that? It's me sewing, me reaping. What the fuck? The fuck?
This is terrible. What?
But I would love to have had like just a little bit of seeing some of it from Detritus' perspective when they're down at the kind of dwarf reception and approaching the king.
Yes.
More than just teaching the world of Ankh-Morpork's great culture, mostly the inside of the opera house.
Absolutely. It must be, it's particularly odd, isn't it, that trolls are, I mean, not within the dwarf society, but going up to Bonk, that trolls are considered these lesser beings when they are up in the mountains and a pretty good brain capacity at most of the time.
Yeah, and then also a lot bigger and stronger.
Mm.
I feel like it's maybe just they're sort of fewer in number.
Yeah. Yeah, you can pretend that they're not real people when you never come across them. Huh. It's almost got some kind of parallels.
Wow.
To real life. Huh.
Huh.
I mean, I don't believe there's anybody whose brains are made of silicon, but I can't prove that.
Don't upset our new AI overlords, Francine.
I never would. You know I never would.
No, that's fair.
I'm not even pretending to be on side. I'm well up for it.
They can probably
upload me.
I, for one, welcome the new benevolent AI dictators.
I say that. I've been playing on the AI art app again a lot recently, and it's a little terrifying. Oh, I'm on the waiting list for DALL-E 2, and I'm going to be so pleased when I get in there.
I've been playing on Wombo Dream. Seeing weird DALL-E images on Twitter, which is great. McDonald's funeral, that was a good one.
Yeah, these are all like the DALL-E mini ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
I've not really spent any time on that because the traffic's too high and I can't be asked. But I bought a premium thing on the Wombo art app. I love seeing that, just generating art, and you get to play with lots of different keywords, and like you can start making it better once you start realizing what to put in, and like there's a Discord channel. It's really cool.
That does sound really fun. Right, anyway, Angua.
Sure. Yes. Is also a character.
I'm going to get us back on track. Angua is not overly happy to see Carrot because Carrot has turned up sleep deprived with no winter gear, having not eaten anything.
Yeah, I mean, he's not made himself an asset to the mission, has he?
I have a lot of sympathy for her in this moment because she's dealing with like all this family drama, Gavin, who's come all this way for her, and she's just like, and now I have to look after this.
In fairness, again, with the you could have sent a runner.
Like, could have left a note.
Yeah, yeah. I've got sympathy for her in this moment. However, what did she expect?
I think, honestly, she probably did expect Carrot to follow a little bit. Like, it sort of implied that maybe he knew that she'd hear of him on the howl. But I think she assumed Carrot would follow, because Carrot is normally so sensible. I think she assumed that he would follow, like, wearing
like
winter clothes
person.
And with supplies.
Yeah.
Like, that he would have stopped to think, because that's what he does.
And probably she'd only admit to herself that she thought he would stay in the city anyway.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he never leaves the city. But he did, because he loves her so. And that's very sweet and gratifying. But also, oh my fucking God, Carrot. No, nothing to eat for 3 days, huh? Great, good, well done.
Anyway, going on from Angua to Gavin.
What a weird name for an alpha wolf.
Brought me a lot
of joy. I know a
few
Gavins.
And none of them are particularly alpha.
Most of them are fine. Not very nice, but just not like...
I dislike both of the Gavins, I know. Oh. They're weird pub Gavins.
I know one weird pub Gavin. Gavin the Wolf, yes, is...
Gavin the Wolf. Well, he ate someone called Gavin once.
That's right, yes.
That's why his name
probably
is
just
Gavin.
Ate a normal Gavin, yeah. He is not a dog. Very important.
He is not a dog. There's a great moment where he's getting a bit threatening with another wolf and does a sort of herm. And Gaspard is thinking of it as
wolf impression. Loved it. Really vibrated the bones.
Right down inside Gaspard's bones, it bounced a harmonic which said, at this point we could go two ways. There is the easy way, and that is very easy. You will never know about the hard way. But there's kind of like a Carrot parallel. Like Carrot has that very similar attitude of...
Sorry, no, that didn't
work. Francine.
I do apologise. Brackets miscreant.
I'm gonna change my Zoom name to Joanna Brackets Miscreant. Right, sorry, yeah, the parallel. I can't stop saying it, Francine. Yeah, you've broken.
Well, you
me.
Saw what happened as soon as it popped into my head. It was coming out. I'm sorry, but yeah, I get that. I think I agree. He's
in a less violent way, but Carrot is the very
it's different species again, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
Carrot's not people. Carrot is people. Gavin's not people.
Carrot probably rarely has to pee on things to establish territory.
I think the Carrot not immediately being best friends with Gavin was really like a really powerful demonstration of wolves not being people. Like yes. in the Carrot gets along with everybody.
And yeah, the wolves not having humanity. And that not necessarily being a bad thing.
No, no. Although then I feel like the next paragraph almost with anthropomorphizing them when it's like, and they're saying just far away back from the fire to be independent. Don't need but no also, fire wolves.
I think it's impossible to write wolves as characterful and not anthropomorphize with them.
Absolutely. Especially if you're, you know, trying to be vaguely amusing.
Yeah, poor little
vaguely
Gaspone.
Amusing,
his,
sorry,
poor little Gaspone and his flirting attempts.
Well, I'm not sympathetic towards anyone who goes off and says, "What's up, bitch?" and strikes out, to be honest. What?
What
did you say? Where I come from, we eat things like you.
That's amazing, Francine. Thank you.
Thank you. We did promise some bad accents, and I feel like we've not delivered really yet. So,
oh, I'm definitely saving mine up for next week.
Good.
The gloomy trousers of Uncle Vanya.
Ah, yes, the gloomy trousers.
But yeah, Carrot himself, you know, like as we were talking about, kind of gambling on the Howl and Angua coming looking for him.
Mm.
Because as much as Carrot is wholesome Carrot, he's also not stupid and possibly quite manipulative in ways.
But we'll never know.
But we'll never know. Because we never see it from... I know you want to talk about perspective shifts a bit more later, but it's more noticeable in this that we never really see anything from his perspective. We're never in his head the way we are with Angua or with Vimes or with Gaspode. Right, Colin, who is being a wanker.
Yeah, unsurprising. Not more of a wanker or less than last time, I don't think, really.
No, busting out more slurs as he loses his shit with everyone and immediately confronted with the Guild of Watchmen, which is something that brings me joy. Nobby's unionised.
Yep. Police unions, generally a bad idea. In this case, probably justified.
I mean, within the context of Discworld Link Morpork, ignoring the realities of, you know, round world policing, a Guild of Watchmen actually makes quite a lot of sense.
I don't know. Is it necessary when Kylan's not in charge?
Less for the unionising aspect, but for maybe the organising aspect.
Like?
I don't know. I don't feel like I haven't thought this through enough now. If it's run as one of the Discs guilds, the Ankh Morpork guilds, I feel like in some ways they get a lot more respect than their current kind of still somewhat underdog status.
Yeah, but I don't think that's good. I don't think the police should be respected like that, honestly. I think the fact they are this underdog civilian ragtag band of miscreants.
I think because I'm thinking about it so much in the context of these watchmen who aren't bad.
Yes. Nobby, though?
Oh, right. Good point. Maybe I didn't really think this point through. I'm going to move us on.
I'm amazed that Red Shoe didn't just take over as head, as clearly the natural leader of a union effort.
I feel like Nobby's in charge pretty much in name, and he's the best person to go and talk to Fred specifically.
Yeah, everyone knows Nobby.
I also feel like I feel like there's going to be a Nobby veterinary conversation in the next section, but I feel like Nobby can talk to veterinary in a way where Reg might struggle.
Yes.
Captain Tantony.
Ah, he's nice.
He's very sweet. And wins a prize because his eyes barely flickered when Vimes tell him he's got a fly on his nose. Which I feel is like a more portable version of the orange test.
A more portable version of the orange test, yes.
Well, in that you don't need to throw an orange.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. What the world has been crying out for. A more portable version of the orange test. Now with holds Wi-Fi.
Up, holds up a kumquat.
Yeah.
And then D, the ideas taster, which is such a...
Already kind of ramping up the neuroses.
I do just generally enjoy the scene when Vimes is taken in and sat with D and they're... Everyone's very pointedly ignoring the rabble of noise from just outside the door as they react to everything that's said.
Yes.
And D is just like escalating the volume louder and louder. And that won't be necessary. It won't be advisable. Everything is fine. And then the Low King, Rhys Reason, who is apparently quite unassuming as far as dwarfs go.
Yeah. It's like, oh, and you just look like a dwarf.
Yeah. And has kind of come into this political context through not being the offensive choice.
It's happened to a few world leaders.
He's like a Lib Dem 15 years ago.
Yeah.
15? 10? However long
how
ago.
Old am I? Yeah, something like that. 13 years ago. Whatever. He's Nick Clegg, is what we're saying.
Yes, he is Nick Clegg.
Except I assume he's not going to go on to work for one of the world's most evil corporations after he retires.
The point is...
The point is...
He's bland, he's acceptable to almost everyone, apart from the people that really wanted Albrecht Albertson.
Because he seems reasonably affable and like he wants to make things better in a peaceful way, so that's good.
Well, I like this kind of 1-2-3 of you have the meeting with the Low King, the meeting with Lady Margolossa, then the meeting with the wolves, and the politicking at Vimes, getting less and less subtle as he works his way through. But Rhys is kind of lacking his own sort of subtlety that works very well, which is when he's just very calmly explaining, yeah, they used to call me lawn ornament and short ass, and sort of watching for the reaction.
Testing Vimes for honesty, which has echoes of what's his chops, Prince and Jingo.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
Like, what did that person say? A slur.
Yeah.
Is it still the same in Ankh-Morpork? Because, like, well, it's better than it was, but no, you'd probably still get insulted. Yeah.
Yeah, people are still going to be dicks. Yeah. Sauce, mate. But yeah, then you go into Lady Margolossa and her sort of fairy tale castle and her twin set in pearls, because she's gone for the very subtle look, with a sitting room in which every conceivable piece of furniture was upholstered in chintz.
I enjoyed the "I try to look on the bright side" little line there. I thought that was quite clever.
Yes.
Kind of a little hint at stepping away from vampirism.
Yeah. I also like the description of her as she looked like someone's mother, possibly someone who'd had an expensive education and a pony called Fidget.
Yeah, definitely.
But her subtle, like, trying to push the drink on Vimes to see how he reacts, because you kind of don't realise it's a political move until you see the wolves do the same thing a lot more clumsily, where they just keep trying to give him a drink.
She doesn't try and give him a drink though, does she? She offers him bull's blood and then lemonade, wasn't
it? No, but she brings it up.
She
talks around
it. She's an alcoholic. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the wolves just keep trying to give him a drink.
Yeah.
And then she kind of almost completely digs into, to the point of nearly eviscerating his character. And that's just the really nice, "I have learned everything about your personality I possibly could," which must be quite terrifying to be confronted with.
By a stranger. Yeah, for sure.
Especially by a stranger who you're already, like, slightly scared of / really don't trust.
Yes. What do you think the weird vibe was when she asked him how old Vetinari was now?
I feel like it could have been, you're supposed to think that Vetinari is maybe a vampire.
Ah. See, I was, like, more thinking she's genuinely lost track of time and can't remember how old her fling would be these days.
Also,
but I think it
that.
Could go either way. Yeah, I like that.
And then, yeah,
vibes.
We have the Baron and Baroness, who, as I mentioned, are a bit clumsier when it comes to the politics.
Yeah. Yeah, they think they're being, well, no, he doesn't. She does think she's being smart and is just being run circles by Vimes, is equally clumsy but doesn't give a fuck. Bath, Vetinari.
Yeah, the subtlety is not really there, but I think we can forgive him that, because the subtlety is not there on any sides.
No, he's not trying, is he, either? Is it?
It's great when he notices the wolf that's clearly Wolfgang.
Mm.
Like Angua, it had this sense of movement still, but where Angua always seemed to looked as if she was poised to flee, this one looked poised to leap.
Mm. Yes.
Which is a fun little comparison, because we haven't seen the two of them together yet.
No, yes.
And then
yes,
when we meet
yes,
him...
Yes, fight or flight.
Yeah. And they've clearly got different ways of handling things. And then when we meet him in sort of human form, we get the much deeper, like, oh no, those aren't.
Ah, sorry.
She knows I'm talking about wolves. But yes, anyway. Wolfgang doesn't have animal eyes or wolf eyes. He has the eyes of a bottle covey or sodden nutter.
Yep, yep, yep. Somebody who will shatter a bottle on a table and then try and stab you with it over a relatively small disagreement for
yes.
anyone who's not familiar with horrible pups.
Possibly a hint of tea time to him, actually. He's got that same
yeah.
total lack of middle gears.
And the mad eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But two matching mad eyes in this case, though, which
yeah.
tea time was somewhat lacking.
Yeah. I think Pratchett definitely leans into the trope, which I particularly like, which is just describing the fact that this villain has fucking mad eyes.
Yes. And there's like the implication that goes with it of this villain won't be reasoned with or get yeah. a nice sweet redemption arc.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh. And then places.
Any villain massively off track here.
Yeah.
Are there any villain redemption arcs in this one? Probably one to talk about next week, isn't it? Let's keep an eye out for redemption arcs.
Yes. Listeners, if you spot a redemption arc, send it to
report
us on the postcard.
Report it to your local... Oh, right.
Report it to your local authorities.
They are invasive species.
Invasive redemption arcs. Locations, this is, didn't really need to go in. It was just I enjoyed that it was referenced, which is Vimes threatening to put something where the sun doesn't shine.
Yes.
And Inigo saying, that's the amusingly named place in Lanka, isn't it?
Mm. I also like that Lanka was mentioned briefly.
Yes,
they've
got an embassy.
Fit across that. Why have they got an embassy? They've rented a house for the occasion. Right.
But I really want to think about this because either King Verence and Queen Margaret have come themselves or they've sent a diplomat.
Mm, which is definitely Seanog.
Which is definitely Seanog. And I'm trying
possibly
to
possibly with his mum tagging along against his will.
It doesn't make sense for Verence and Margaret to have come just because I can't imagine a version of these events where Margaret doesn't end up involved.
Maybe Verence on his own?
Maybe Verence on his own. Maybe Margaret's,
if Margaret's got other things to do and this doesn't seem important.
And there's a baby and they don't want to take the baby on the coach all that way. In which case, yes, Verence would probably just be very helpful and around. But I really like the idea of it being short.
Yeah.
Possibly with Nanny supervising. But then how much would you enjoy a scene between Nanny Og and Lady Sybil?
Where Nanny Og demolishes a pyramid of Ferrero Rocher while Lady Sybil's very polite and secretly impressed.
Just standing there holding the Ferrero Rocher while Nanny just goes to town on it.
Is this is a good point. Is this an internationally recognised reference, the Ferrero Rocher ambassador thing?
That's a good point. I don't know.
Possibly not. Anyone who's not familiar with old English, I think, adverts, there was a very famous advert about Ferrero Rocher, which are little chocolates with wafer spheres.
But they're wrapped in gold.
Yeah, and it's basically being shown around an ambassadorial party. It was like, oh, ambassador, you do spoil us. And everyone's remembered it because it's very silly and fun. And did you know that it was incredibly different to make those spheres of wafer? And that was quite an architectural challenge. Yeah, Jack was telling me about that. Hmm.
Huh.
I've got a lot of track. Ambassador for Roche, Nanny Og, Seanog.
Lanka. We're in locations. You've marked underground as a location. Do you mean a specific area underground?
No.
Okay. Just in general, quite like
it. Yeah, no, I couldn't remember. I didn't know. Is there like a name for the town that the dwarves are living in? I tried to scroll back and find it, but I couldn't.
No, I've just been referring it as to like the mines.
Yeah, the mines, yeah. Anyway, yeah, that is a location that was interesting because Vimes was imagining, little mines. Sure, he was imagining things. Little cottages. And yes, this huge city of an underground place with a lot of candles in the end. Please, you must tell me how you've achieved such a delightful lighting effect here. Lots of candles.
This is when Sybil's in her full Duchess mode, isn't it?
Sybil's gone full Duchess.
Let fly the Duchess. I also promised that I only said, and they called it a mine, 3 or 4 times to myself while reading this section.
Lord of the Rings?
Yes. Film, Gimli's waxing poetic about the beauty of Moria before they turn up and like, this isn't a mine, it's a tomb.
Yes, I remember now. Yep. I can't remember what, if anything, I wanted to say about the underground if it wasn't just the stars. Oh no, the whole sleuth system I found really cool as well.
Oh yeah. And experiencing a lift for the first time.
Yes. Yeah.
Because he's just sort of going into it like, there's not another door out? What the fuck?
Yeah, no, it's the defamiliarisation thing again, isn't it? It's,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and you've just gotten used to a normal lift, then you get put in the seasick lift, which I also would not enjoy.
I feel like that would be quite fun.
Oh, I don't know. I don't. It's claustrophobia and fear of drowning at the same time. I'm not. You're all right underground. I'm very claustrophobic.
That book you gave me, the Gastro Atlas.
Oh yeah.
Mentioned in the England section that there's in Nottingham, because there's loads of cave systems around there, there's like an underground cocktail bar you can go to that's like massively underground and built into caves, and now
sounds
I really want to
like
go there.
Kind of nonsense.
Yep, so I need to go to Nottingham.
I bet they have cheese somewhere.
They probably do have cheese. I feel like the cave was originally kind of used for like beer storage or something.
Yeah.
Because consistent temperatures. Anyway.
Do I just assume that all caves have cheese because the one cave we went to had cheese?
I think, honestly, it's because we took you to Wookiee Hole and now you just assume all caves have cheese.
That's the cave I've been to and therefore, yeah.
All caves have cheese.
All caves have cheese and dangerous chandelabras. Chandeliers.
Chandelabras, I like it. By your same logic and based on that same holiday, Neil Gaiman will be there whenever you go to Bath.
Will he not? No. By that same logic, every time I go into a civic building in Bath, there should be a Neil Gaiman.
Okay, right.
So it'll be fine. Was it? Was it a theatre or something?
I think it was a theatre. Yeah. I don't remember. It was many years ago.
It was.
Anyway,
I like the Turkish convenience shop.
I like the Turkish Iranian, convenience shop.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
The Cheetos were Iranian.
That's right. The guy was Turkish.
Yeah. The watermelons were giant.
The vibes were immaculate.
You have to edit this.
No, I don't.
All right, yeah, no, put it out, full. I'm fine with that.
Right, so what now?
We take
Can
a break.
Can we stop? Can we go away?
We've still got half
Is
the
that
episode.
Enough? All right, but... yes, well, yes, that's for future us in 5 minutes.
Let's take five and then we'll record the rest of the episode. How does that sound, cool. Francine?
That sounds good. What's in that?
Rosé and not what it looks like, which is a massive glass of whiskey.
Okay, good, yeah.
Don't worry.
I didn't even try to mask my concern there.
Don't worry, I have not started just chugging huge glasses of straight spirits on the podcast.
No, good.
The listeners don't need that. Right. Little bits we liked.
Mm-hmm.
Perspective.
You're a perspective.
I am a perspective.
I thought practice kind of use of perspective in this was particularly interesting.
Yeah, the way he makes the hands seem really far away.
Actually, we could probably tie that in with the fucking mountains. He kept thinking that he could
reach out and touch.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Very nice. Well, thank you for letting me get through my first sentence on track. And let's start as we mean to go on.
I'm not sorry.
I know. And the fight scene right at the beginning.
Yeah.
So because it's such a confusing scene, actually, I had to read it a couple times to find out, like, to understand what was happening.
Who's doing what.
Yeah. And I think in order to give us any chance at all, he had to shift from Vimes to Inigo, which he wouldn't usually do, like, midway through a scene. So it went from Vimes' point of view to Inigo made out the shape that appeared at the very edge of the light. And it felt, that was very movie-ish, I thought, that whole scene.
Yeah.
More so than most of it in this book. And I thought that was pretty cool. I thought that it was interesting how they did it with Sybil as well, because we've had Sybil's perception of things a couple of times in this book, at least once anyway. But I think he deliberately didn't when we were working up to the revelation about her crying and him not noticing.
Yeah.
Which I think was a...
She needs to be, like, off to the side for that to work as a revelation.
Yeah. Quite cool to see Gaspode as the straight man for Carrot, whose view we're never allowed from Carrot's perspective. We've talked about that in other episodes, because that would ruin the mystery.
Yeah.
Of what the fuck is Carrot about?
And what's he actually thinking about?
Yeah. And while we do get anglers every now and then, as you said, it would kind of ruin the mystery of human romances.
Well, and also, like, the whole point of her, I don't know, attitude perspective is that on paper it doesn't make logical sense that she's annoyed by the fact Carrot isn't annoyed.
Yes.
So I think if you see it from her point of view, it doesn't work as well.
Yeah, you'd have to, like, really spell out with the, like, I know it doesn't make sense, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, which can be done well, but, and then the heads?
Oh, the heads on the wall scenes. I know in theory it's not like a nice idea that there's a decapitated troll on the wall, but these two scenes together, I don't know why they've always stuck in my brain from this book, and I find them very sweet. Mm-hmm. When they first walk in, they see the troll head and they're sort of trying to stand in front of it. And
I'm not that wide.
I'm not that tall or that wide. And then Detritus, who's obviously a lot quicker on the uptake up here, is immediately going... being very calm about it and saying, yeah, there was a lot of that. Here's this bit of human skull I carry around.
Yeah. There's a definite difference to me between having the keepsake, as kind of weird as that is, and, like, proudly displaying a trophy. So I think he's definitely being gracious about it, or as gracious as you can be while waving around a bit of skull.
Yeah, no, I think he is being very gracious about it. And he's very calm when he explains why it's okay, when he says that things are different. And now you don't chop off our heads, and we don't make drums out of your skin, and everything is hunky-dory.
Little reminder that I can make a drum out of your skin, but hunky-dory.
But I think it's also like he wants to acknowledge that there has been that very fraught past.
Yeah, and it was two-way. They weren't just victims.
No.
Yeah.
And I think he wants it to be appreciated that he's not making drums out of anyone's skin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. He's like, yeah, no, I know. I'm not just someone to be protected here.
But yeah, then the other moment.
You know, there's a gun called the Peacemaker, not spelled like that.
Oh, right.
It's a type of revolver, apparently. Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah. But similarly, yeah. Ironic. Vibes. Why do I keep saying vibes today? I've forgotten all my thesauruses, synonyms.
You've forgotten all your thesauruses.
I've forgotten all my thesauruses. It's like that nightmare. You wake up in an exam hall in your pants and you've forgotten all of your thesauruses.
My many, many thesauruses. But yeah, the follow-up scene when the heads are being taken off the walls.
Yes.
And Vimes and Sybil are very quietly like rolling over and half asleep naming them, and they both say swordfish together, which I did just note with a little heart next to it. I don't know why, but it brings me a lot of joy to just imagine them both doing swordfish.
What did you think of the three empty hooks, though?
In the werewolf one?
Yeah.
I feel like it's implied that that was a troll as well.
Yes.
And that they've
not
heard...
Not people, do you think?
Could be people.
I think you're right that it's trolls, but...
I think they heard from the embassy
and
got rid of things before Vimes kicked off.
Yeah.
That's how I read it, but it could be people.
Yeah. Or could be yet to be filled, as they said.
Yes.
Because they are fond of the game. And
anticipatory.
I see you hanging hooks in
Wait for it.
Patient.
Anyway, security system, Francine.
It is difficult to properly assess or to audit one's own system. And it is very important to get in outside auditors. And I think this is very well demonstrated here as Vimes comes into this quite smart looking setup that they've clearly been sticking to for hundreds of years without incident and immediately pulls it apart with Shuri. Yeah. Like, okay, I can see four ways we could break this. Like, come on, dudes. And I sympathize very much with Vimes, who's going in and like, stop doing things just because that's how you've always done it. And with them, because it is very difficult to see the obvious problems with something you've built from the ground up a lot of the time, which is why you should always
bring in external auditors.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or auditors, yeah. And yeah, I think that ties into, isn't really the same point, but they're made about Inigo talking about the Clax Tower. Now you, your grace, and myself as well, because we are bastards, Vimes supplied. Well, yes. And I like his straightaway idea for the Clax not being able to be operated unless the trapdoor was shut. And well, you know me, I like a bit of automation, as do you.
But the thinking through, like, you need to know if there's someone up here, you need to know why, you need to think through the actual risks of it.
Yeah. And then Inigo is an extra level of bastard, so he's like, no, we need to wait till night before we send this, because who's to say the next two towers aren't also empty now?
Yeah.
Poor Inigo.
Poor Inigo. He does have a rough time of it, doesn't he?
He does. I like to think he enjoyed some of it.
Oh, yeah, I think he had fun.
I like to think.
He had a nice outing before he was brutally murdered.
He did go down with, like, respect, though, didn't he? He's like, oh, they are clever. Mm.
I feel like he appreciated a job well done during his murder.
Yes, I suppose for an assassin.
Yeah, you
maybe
sort of appreciate the craftsmanship.
He seemed so much less enamoured with the idea that those assassins had been kidnapped and the receipt and all of that was very distasteful, whereas, could you just tell me where you put the body? It was just simple.
Yeah.
Politeness,
And it's kind of that thing if he assumes everyone deals with things the way he would potentially deal with an assassin being sent after him.
Several knives.
And I think he's also somewhat putting himself in the centerway assassin's shoes because they're put in particularly powerless positions. And Inigo is obviously, having come from sort of nothing and risen his way up, does not joyfully anticipate being in that sort of powerless position again.
Yeah. I've now got Malcolm solves his problems with the chainsaw in my head, so...
Beautiful. Perfect.
Inigo solves his problems with several knives hidden about his person. And he never has the same problem twice.
Anyway.
Except he did, unfortunately. So, food?
Food. So my initial Googling of fats up, I stupidly was looking at like fat soups, historical recipes. Don't Google the word fat followed by any kind of food stuff, because what you will get is 18 million hits for best fat burning soups.
Fat burning soup?
Yep. There was a lot of cabbage soup advertised to me. Most of the links I found for fats up, there's some kind of dog food supplement thing called fats up. So that cute, also takes yeah. up a lot of Google. But I've linked to the recipe I found in the show notes, which is sort of a beer and garlic and sausage stew type thing that I'd eat.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as sounds your nourishing. Date did as well.
It's the sort of thing I'd...
Beer, sausage and garlic.
Hey, if your date's Nanny Og, you're in for a good night.
Absolutely. Well, it doesn't matter what you eat if your date's Nanny Og.
Yeah. Good point. But yes, on the list of menu options that Igor provides, we have Walago, Noggi, Thuglot, Thwainfle and Thothages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of historical basis apart from the fact that things like dumplings and stuff are very prevalent in the cultures we're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't think there's actually a pastry made from curtains.
Was it talking about like flax?
Buckwheat, which is very popular in that area. I don't know the ins and outs of agriculture, but I believe it's easier to grow in colder climates.
Okay.
Which is why it's very popular in like Russian cooking. You have a lot of like buckwheat pancakes and things. In this case, Noggi are apparently buckwheat dumplings. I'm assuming the actual name is referenced. Yes, I assume so. The thglot is apparently bread made from parsnips, which I couldn't find much of a historical influence on. I'm not sure I'd want to make bread from parsnips.
Parsnip, parmesan and sage bread from Delia Online. And if Delia isn't our shortcut to genuine Slavic recipes,
then probably a genuine Slavic person would be.
Yes, maybe that. I don't maybe know how that. To Google in Cyrillic, Joanna.
Me neither, and that's why I don't have a lot of details on this.
I'm just mushing several cultures together in an incredibly offensive way, much as I would do with parmesan bread. So let's parmesan bread, parsnip bread. I've just looked at the thing and it's parmesan bread for James McKenzie, Great British Chefs. Yeah, Google is really not helpful for finding
anything food related.
Yeah.
A couple of other food moments I really like. One isn't really a food moment, but I couldn't work out where else to cram it in, and I enjoy the line, Vimes got lost in any song more complex than the sort with titles like Where Has All the Custard Gone? Jelly's Just Not the Same.
I highlighted that as well, yeah.
And then, of course, this is a fairly infamous footnote from the Discworld books. I've seen this quoted many a time. He'd noticed that sex bore some resemblance to cookery. It fascinated people. They sometimes bought books full of complicated recipes and interesting pictures. And sometimes when they were really hungry, they created vast banquets in their imagination. But at the end of the day, they'd settle quite happily for egg and chips if it was well done and maybe had a slice of tomato.
It's a good observation.
It's a good observation. I highly recommend a fried egg and chip sandwich.
Sliced tomato?
Ketchup.
Ah. Tomato in a sandwich works if you're going to eat the sandwich right away.
Yeah, otherwise
you're asking for a soggy sandwich. Unless you're only using the edges of the tomato or taking all the seeds out, and really, who's got time for that?
No. I like a BLT. I like a cheese and tomato sandwich with just a little bit of mayo.
Is it explained later on in the book that BCBs are burnt crispy bits?
Yes.
Okay. Because I know it's been explained before as...
When it comes to food, explained, but now specifically in the fat ones.
I wasn't sure if he'd gone really like, here's a little reference if you've been paying attention.
So should we talk about diplomacy?
Yes, we could, couldn't we?
I'll let you start.
That's very diplomatic of you. So I just like the evisceration of diplomacy, of diplomats, of ambassadorship as the theme in this book. I think Pratchett's had a lot of fun with it, and I think we can all agree that a lot of it is nonsense based in some real need for nations not to be constantly warring. Diplomatic immunity, I thought, was one of the really interesting points from there.
Mm-hmm.
As I told you before we started recording, I did start looking into like, oh, I bet there's some really fun examples, and there's some really unfun examples, so we're not going to go too far into that. But I quite enjoy the fact that as of 2020, diplomats in London owe London over £116 million in congestion charges that they just won't pay because no one's going to do anything about it.
Amazing.
So yeah, New York apparently it's parking fines. Similarly, the whole idea, as I'm sure you know, of like not shooting the messenger, not shooting the envoy, not shooting the diplomat, is ancient times. And I like how it's continued to now. I think it's one of the few truly civilized things we've managed to hold on to as a kind of globe.
To hearken back briefly to the history of clowns rabbit hole I did, it was part of the function of court jesters is that they acted as diplomats and messengers for kings, and they had like a protected status. They weren't to be killed in enemy camps.
Mm-hmm.
Now every time you think of an ambassador, please picture them in a stupid jester hat.
I will. Something that doesn't apply to Vimes, but I quite liked as a concept as I was reading about diplomats in general, was apparently a big issue with one's diplomatic service is that they can become quite detached from their home country, from the patriotism, because they live in another culture for so long.
Yeah.
Sir Harold Nicholson acknowledged that diplomats can become denationalized, internationalized, and therefore dehydrated, an elegant, empty husk.
That is a fabulous sentence.
I know, isn't it? I also liked his then rest of his quote, which tied back into Vimes, which is, nobody who has not actually watched statesmen dealing with each other can have any real idea of the immense part played in human affairs by such unavowable and often unrecognizable causes as lassitude, affability, personal affection or dislike, misunderstanding, deafness or incomplete command of a foreign language, vanity, social engagements, interruptions and momentary health. Which is troubling, and I think what Vimes quibbles with this whole thing, isn't it? It's like, what the fuck am I doing here? Why am I meant to be, why are any of these people with their weird niceties?
Well, it's a reminder that, you know, at the bottom of all of this is not perfectly bred automatons, but human beings who will react to each other very humanly.
Yeah. But I mean, in this case, I think Vimes is both automatically doing it and also finding some distaste in kind of spreading the Ankh-Morpork is the best sentiment, which is what you kind of looked at a bit, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's this idea of a kind of diplomat out of water thing. And it's really interesting, especially comparing this book back to Jingo, which is the last watch book we had. And in that, Vimes is diplomating, but on his home turf. And by the time he makes it to Klatch, he's not really there for diplomacy, such as he's basically in hot pursuit. He is trying to persecute a crime that took place in Ankh-Morpork, and he is very much just following the Ankh-Morpork law. And we already kind of talked about where he handles it well, where he's kind of a dick, where he has to be called out on, let us be bastards too.
Yes.
And it's very interesting to see the lessons he's taken to Uberwald from Klatch, obviously having gone home for a bit first.
Yeah.
Where he's now fully aware that everyone can be a bastard.
I wonder if it's made easier here by the fact he has worked alongside dwarves and trolls and not so much Klatchians.
But then you look at his distrust of, well, vampires, Lady Margolossa, mostly. He actually has a comparative amount of trust for some of the werewolves because he's worked with Angua. And he's sort of thinking, I'm dealing with her family. Yeah. Oh, wait, never mind.
No, you're horrible. Okay.
No. Oh, God, you're horrible. You're why she doesn't live here.
Oof. Yikes.
You're why she lives in Ankh-Morpork, aren't you?
Well, I thought the phrase padded with years was interesting, by the way. Just kidding.
No, I like that description of her.
I also really like the very brief but intriguing description of her dress, which I want.
The dark green.
Yeah.
I really love that colour.
Yeah.
I know it's only described, you don't see it, but I love
I'm like, imagining that like Perilyn green thing.
Yes, that's been going around on Tumblr. Anyway, sorry. So he's looking at this idea of definitions of good guy. Inigo talks to him about there are definitions that don't automatically mean like Ankh-Morpork. Mm. And that's the thing Vimes has to kind of untangle, because he's there as an Ankh-Morpork diplomat. He's got to do not what's best for people. It's not just what's morally right, but what's best for Ankh-Morpork.
Yes.
But then he knows at the back of his mind he's been sent there because there's been some sort of crime. And what he's got to do is the best for untangling the crime, but he's got to work out what the crime is, because what's illegal is different.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, veterinary has not sent me here because I am the best ambassador. for the job of negotiating fat deposits, am I? Obviously, I am not. It would probably be amusing, but if this is important, he wouldn't have sent me for it. So why am I here? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's most of his section, is kind of trying to work out why he's there without pissing anyone off too much, despite the fact he is very pissed off by a lot of them. And you can tell from the fact he's mostly in his element around the dwarves, because they're the most familiar to him. Lady Margolotta sets him on edge because he's so uncomfortable around vampires. Mm. The werewolves set him on edge because they're Nazi wolves.
They do set people on edge, Nazi wolves, I've noticed.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of... I love wolves, one of my favourite animals. Nazi wolves. Less of a fan.
Yeah.
Inside me, there are two wolves. Both of them are far too hot, honestly. It's roasting in here. But he confronts it. Like I said, he finds himself almost more comfortable around the dwarves because he's been around them. Mm. They are human to him. And I don't mean that in a insulting way, but I mean he feels very... It feels familiar. It feels like, you know, somewhat being an Morpork, because he's thinking a dwarf is a dwarf is a dwarf. Yeah. And it's put him in this different weird fish out of water moment where, like, Cheery has to kind of quietly keep explaining to him, like,
yeah. No, dwarf, I think isn't kind a dwarf, of, a dwarf, a dwarf, a
dwarf. Yeah. Dwarf isn't a dwarf, a dwarf, a dwarf. And no, it will mean quite a lot to us if Albrightson becomes the king and we're declared not dwarves anymore, because...
Yeah, you didn't know a lot about this, but minds were collapsed on top of hundreds of people, and yeah
explaining this kind of hidden war that took place, this idea of the Knockermen, and Vimes thinking to himself, wondered why the hell it was that dwarves believed they had no religion. Being a dwarf was a religion. People went into the dark for the good of the clan and heard things and were changed and came back to tell.
And had a religious schism, and yeah.
And had a religious schism based on mining technology, which is a really fascinating idea. This book does it so well. And he gets this kind of confusion, bearing in mind you have Sherry, who's like one of the first out female dwarves, and even she's correcting him when he's asking about Blood Axe and Ironhammer and going, oh no, they're both dwarves.
Yeah.
You have to understand. I've come out as female, but it still doesn't matter. Like, at the end of the day, they're both dwarfs.
Yeah. Neither of them chose to.
No.
Yeah. That's really cool. Just a Vimes listening as well, isn't it? When he's corrected. He tried, I think, at one point to argue back for a second, and then was like, wait, no.
This is something out of my understanding. But yeah, so I think this is a really good logical continuation of Jingo. The Watchbooks... up to Jingo, like, so, you know, guards, men-at-arms, feet of clay, kind of got stuck in this rut of telling the same story in different ways, which the story being, how do we oust Vetinari?
Yes.
Jingo let the Watch breathe a bit more by giving them something else to do entirely, and mostly did it well. There were a couple of Blair moments that we talked about. But here it lets the Watch breathe by taking it almost entirely out of the city. There are two scenes in the city, the two colon scenes, and that's very much a C-plot there for comic relief.
Yeah.
And it's such a testament to how the characters are written that they've grown so much from book to book that you can take Vimes from almost making the war worse in pursuit of a crime. Mm. And it probably would have got a lot worse if Leshp hadn't disappeared, to actively working to solve a crime and in the process prevent a civil war in a different country. The growth that requires... The writing that is required to put that kind of character growth in between two books is incredibly impressive.
How much character growth do you think it takes, though? Because at the end of the day, would he stop trying to solve that crime if that was the right thing to do to stop the war?
Oh, that's an interesting one. And I hadn't thought about that.
I think he's closer to maybe being able to make that decision, but It does seem very much like Vetinari knows where to put him.
Yes. He is still very much, I think he's been described already as Vetinari's terrier.
Yeah.
And he is still very much going where he's told, which is great when you've got that Margolotta kind of takedown of him.
Mm. But yeah, I mean, he'd have never been able to be so successful talking to Lady Margolotta a couple of books ago.
No, you couldn't see even Feet of Clay Vimes managing to talk to Lady Margolotta.
No. Struggled enough with the golems at first.
But that's what I mean. He's listened, he's learned, and now he knows to talk to people. it's a more interesting thing to watch, and it makes the fish out of water story a lot more fun to watch, because we've just watched Fiennes learn how to accept what Ankh-Morpork is and uphold the law within it and become quite proud of it.
Mm.
I know he doesn't like being a duke or being married to a duchess, but I think he is, you know, underneath quite proud of his station within the city and what he's managed to do for the city.
And he was capable of setting Sybil off in full duchess when it benefited the situation.
Yes, he's learned how to use the duchess.
And learning from Sybil's being able to walk somewhere, knowing that nobody would ever stop you.
Yes, he's learned the clipboard walk.
Yes.
But now he's been taken, like I said, he's got this out of water thing, and then suddenly he's put in a context where he doesn't have the backing of Ankh-Morpork law. He has the backing of Ankh-Morpork diplomacy, but not law.
Yeah.
And
all of his protections are gone.
And he's got to kind of paddle a lot harder to get to the surface. I'm trying to continue the fish out of water thing here.
If a fish wants to get to the surface, then so be it.
Exactly. But if it's out of the water, it needs to get under the surface.
He's got to flap a lot harder to get back in the water.
I feel like I said something intelligent like 5 minutes back, so I'm going to leave this here and ask you for an obscure reference for Neil Francine.
All right, let's flail towards the end of the podcast, i.e. the pond. So working deep underground in mines, you do need something to light your way, because otherwise you're kind of fucked. And most mines don't have the helpful Skyrim dungeon glowing mushrooms. But as on Discworld, bringing fire, whether that's a lamp, a torch, or a candle, into a mine on Roundworld was rife with danger, because mines contain pockets of fire damp, which is methane, which when mixed with air becomes explicitly dangerous.
Yes.
From solutions in gas detection. In the early 19th century, we have the first recorded gas detector or gas tester. They enlisted a person to wear a wet blanket and carry a wick with the end lit on fire. They would move the lit wick along the walls of the mine, and if there was a pocket of methane gas, the wick would ignite. The damp blanket kept the tester safe most of the time. However, sometimes large pockets of methane caused the entire area to be engulfed in flames.
So it was a risky job.
It was a risky job. The risk was largely accepted, but it became more common as mining became deeper and more of these pockets became...
Were found.
Thank you. Underground explosions were common, but the impetus to find a solution to the problem, this is from Mining Heritage, came from the Felling Pit disaster of 1812, which 92 men and boys were killed.
Jesus.
And literally in the next couple of years, the first flame safety lamps came about. So they were oil lamps with mesh covers, almost as described in the Discworld here, which stopped the flame igniting the methane. When the flame rose higher with these first ones, that's how you knew you were in the presence of methane.
Mm-hmm.
The technology was developed in various parts by George Stephenson, Dr. William Reed Clanny, and Sir Humphrey Davy, who presented his design in 1815. He did refuse to patent it, although it did become known as the Davy lamp.
Right.
In the late 1800s, Sir William Garforth, excellent name, developed the Garforth lamp, which resembles more closely a device used on the Discworld because the flame does turn blue. In the presence of methane.
Amazing.
Okay, I think I managed to keep that fairly brief.
Well done. I feel like I should also just throw in the mention that there were canaries for checking for certain types of gas that would knock you out as well.
Yes.
Hence the phrase canary in a coal mine.
Yes, I thought that was probably fairly non-obscure.
It is, but I feel like if we talked about mine safety, we should mention the canaries.
Poor little canaries.
Poor little canaries. Right, I think we've said everything we could possibly say about part two of The Fifth Elephant. You look really confused, though, so now I'm concerned I've missed something important.
No. I'd just gone back to the page, and apparently canaries didn't, like, pass out or whatever when they got gas. They would start shaking their cages or stop singing.
Ah, interesting. Well, I'm glad we looked just up canaries.
Unhappy canary was the warning.
Not unconscious.
Mm.
Anyway, right, now we've said everything that we could possibly say about part two of The Fifth Elephant, at least until one of us interrupts the other again, which might happen. We will be back next week with part three, which starts on page 303 in the Corgi paperback, and starts with the lines, "Vimes woke up in darkness." Ooh. Until next week, though, dear listener, you can contact us on Instagram at The Tree Shall Make You Fret.
Weird way to contact us, but fine.
People comment, people say hi. I like it. It makes me happy. Shout out Boston and Slarty Bartfast, who often get, like, we get tagged in posts about them listening. They're cats.
Oh, that's nice.
And we get tagged in posts about them listening. So, yeah, no, do contact them.
Do we now? All right, fine, yeah. Well, you never show me those. So.
Yeah. Tag us on your cat's Instagram accounts.
I think it's actually an act of violence, not showing me things we've been tagged in with cats. But, okay, we'll talk about that later.
Right. Can I do the rest of the outro, Francie?
No, yes.
Fine. All right. You can contact us on Twitter at MakeYouFretPod. Is that acceptable, Francine?
Yeah, no, I don't care. I've tuned out now. Carry on.
Okay. Facebook at The True Shall Make You Fret. Join our subreddit community, r/TTSMYF. Email us your thoughts, queries, castles, snacks, and terrified canaries, thetrueshallmakeyoufretpod@gmail.com. Yes, Francine.
Do we want like a Lady Margalotta castle or more of a werewolfy castle?
Like Lady Margalotta, but then with like the werewolves furniture, because that sounds more comfortable. I don't like chintz.
All right, cool. Yeah,
like fairy tale on the outside.
Yeah,
kind of dingy but like comfy on the inside.
Okay, but with a moat, so that we do have a defense.
But with a moat and like no decapitated heads.
Okay, cool.
Comedy taxidermy only.
Yeah.
And if you would like to support us financially, so that we can buy our own comedy taxidermy for our eventual castle.
And I don't have to try and make it.
Didn't your husband once try and taxidermy a stoat?
Yes, and I don't want to see that again.
Anyway, no, sorry. You can go to patreon.com/thetrueshallmakeyoufret and exchange your hard-earned pennies for bonus nonsense, and we can spend them on therapy for Francine because of the time with the stoat. And until next time... Dear listener,
don't let us detain you. When you read the bit about like where they got into the spy on bit in the wall,
yeah.
Did you read the, did you do the nano imp voice aloud as you read that bit?
Yeah, obviously.
Don't speak me for